Glenn on the Free FM. And I'm sitting here with Michael Goudeau, as always. You know, Michael Goudeau, we've had a lot of the aristocrats on the show.
It's been
so
wonderful.
Far, are you keeping track? Because
I am.
Louis Black, Lisa Lampanelli, Howie Mandel, David Brenner, Wendy Liebman, Gilbert Gottfried, Paul Provenza, Bobby Slayton, Carrot Top, Trey Parker, Drew Carey, and now... I think that you can say pretty safely the smartest aristocrat. We have Meryl Marco.
Hello.
Who was in the movie for like 15 seconds.
15 seconds, yeah. But the best 15 seconds in the movie.
Because you were one of the people that had, you had a whole, everybody else.
I did the work.
Was flying by the seat of their pants.
Yeah, I did the homework.
Yeah, you did homework. You've always been an overachiever?
You know, it's true. I was totally overachieving. You said... do your own take on the joke. So I sat down and tried to figure out my own take on the joke, and I wrote it, and I figured everybody else would be better at being obscene than I was, so I went the other way.
Well, you went the other way. You went smart. You went with art. But your background is all art, right?
Yeah, it is. I'm sorry. I've taken off my headphones now.
That's okay. Right, makes your hair look better.
That's good. Yeah, no, my background is I went to art school and taught art for a year at USC.
Did you really?
I taught
art
painting
history
and drawing.
Or painting and drawing.
Mm-hmm.
So
I got a master's degree. When people say to me, how do you get into television? I say, well, you go get a master's degree in art. And you teach for a year.
And then how did you slide into to comedy from...
Well, I was always had the comedy gene, I mean, since a kid.
Mm-hmm.
But and I actually probably would have gone into drama or acting or something, but my parents wouldn't hear of it. So art school was the next best possibility. It never occurred to me that you could go into.
No, what were you born in the 19th century?
That's right. I was born 1812.
That your parents were against what they think that floozies went into entertainment.
Yeah.
Really?
Basically. Yeah. And were they wrong? No. It's all floozies and damaged people. Don't you agree?
Yeah, I guess you're right.
Yeah.
So are you from L.A.?
No. My parents, they moved a lot. I went to the latter part of high school and college in the Bay Area, San Francisco mm-hmm. Bay Area.
And so, did your parents finally accept you as a in
show business? They didn't mind the art major, which, of course, is even more useless than a show business major would have been of some kind. But yeah. No, they never did. They never did accept me as anything, and I've... since they died, written about them extensively.
so payback's a bitch, Mom and Dad. Yeah. And now, what do you consider yourself? Mostly writing books?
I seem to be mostly writing books now, yeah. Although I've got a screenplay kicking around.
Cool. Yeah. And tell us about the book, because that's what people should buy, right?
People should buy the book, yes. Yeah. I've written, it's a third novel. Mm-hmm. Did you know that I wrote a novel with Andy?
Yes, I did. And I also, I believe, promised you I would read it and then did not
I should have brought you one.
I did not read it.
That was my second novel, Psycho X Game. This one is called, my new novel is called Walking in Circles Before Lying Down, and it's about your favorite thing, a talking dog.
Good. Well, you know, I wrote a book about a talking sock monkey.
I read it, and I thought it was great.
So you read my book. I didn't read yours. I will. See, what I do is
we both read your book, and
I have
read it, too.
Two books that I read over and over again. I read Moby Dick and Atlas Shrugged, and that's 1,800 pages that you read through. So reading those each, you know, every year, it slows you. I should read your book.
You really do read those two every year?
I'm not every year, but I always am reading. I'm always reading one of them or both of them.
Huh.
And when I go to sleep at night, I put on an iPod and listen to Moby Dick until I fall asleep.
Is that right?
Yeah.
And can you recite long passages for me?
I really can't. I always say, this is a section I'm going to memorize, and then I don't get around to it.
Well, that's amazing.
But I just love it.
But then, do you have dreams of whales?
No, I don't. I don't care. You know, to me, Moby Dick isn't about whales. You know,
dreams of Arabs?
Yeah, no, I have dreams of actually Herman Melville in a cave. You know, because there was a Nathaniel Hawthorne and Herman Melville were at a party, a picnic outdoors when they first met, and there was a thunder shower.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody ran to this one area, but Nathaniel and Herman ran to this little cave.
Is this true?
Yes. And they sat for 5 hours talking.
Wow.
So they say. And when they came out of the cave, Herman Melville went back and ripped up everything, all his notes on Moby Dick, and started again with
this
iconic one. And
Nathaniel Hawthorne had a really bad backache.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, That was the two things that changed everything.
Well, so, Herman Melville was the one who, didn't he work at the post office for most of the life?
Yeah, actually, a customs inspector, but close enough. Post office is close enough. Charles Bukowski was the post office. Ah. And also, what's his name from American Splendor? Harvey Pekar. Was the post office has given us some wonderful, wonderful artists.
Artists and serial killers.
So how did you write a book with Andy?
That was really hard.
Because collaborating, you know, I do all the time, and everybody has a different style. So how'd you do it?
Well, this was really a difficult kind of a collaboration because it's every other chapter, two voices.
Mm-hmm.
So, it was based on when I met him, he and I had an email correspondence where we were playing a game, who had the more horrible previous love life, for points. And you give yourselves points for humiliation and complicity and bad behavior and rationalizing things and sticking around anyway. And it was such an entertaining correspondence that I was saving it. And then at such point as he became unencumbered by previous relationship, and he and I started seeing each other.
You were writing these emails while he was in a psychiatric.
He was in a relationship, yeah, and I was not. So I was accumulating this stuff because I thought it was so amusing, and it was also so well written that I thought, well, I got to do something with this at some point, and at some point I did. I took it and we turned it into a book, but then I had to make big flow charts and figure out how you take those things and thread them, and it really bears not much resemblance to the original correspondence, but that was the template originally. Mm-hmm. It's got that game in it, and it's written in two voices. Every other person writes a chapter. What I was having to do in order to get the thing going is I was having to give him assignments because he's a musician and he really didn't want to sit and write. So I would actually, I would let him write anything he wanted, given if he would just follow. It's kind of like the Bible that they use when they write television shows. Mm-hmm. If he would just follow and include these following things that we'd already agreed upon, mm-hmm. he could add any other thing. So when I would get his chapter back, it would have strange plot twists that I didn't expect, which I thought was fantastic.
And you were mostly the editor on.
I was totally the editor of it, but I loved it. I liked his writing so much that it worked out okay. Had I not liked his writing, that could have been the end of everything because that would have been a nightmare.
Well, yeah. Also, musician writing is not. You know,
he's a great writer.
Yeah. Because I knew Andy before I even heard of you. Because people could not have heard of you in the late 70s, right? Could anybody have heard of you?
No, I started writing television in the 80s with Mr. Letterman.
Yeah, and so I knew him. And I always thought his last name is Pretty Boy, right?
Pretty Boy, and then he was better known as having been the front man for Wall of Voodoo.
Right, but I knew him back with Eye Protection.
Yeah.
And I always thought Pretty Boy was one of those, you know.
It's Pretty Boy.
I know, but I always thought he was Pretty Boy, and that was just his thing. But I used to go see Eye Protection all the time.
Yeah, so they're great.
They're a great band. And you said they're recording again.
They're recording at my house as we speak. Three of them. They haven't seen each other in 25. Well, two of them have stayed friends, but the third one they hadn't seen in 25 years, and they're the three of them in his studio, which is formerly my garage, but now soundproof studio.
And they're going to put out an Eye Protection record?
Well, they're going to put something out.
Oh, cool. Cool, cool, cool.
Yeah, they sound great.
So the first thing you wrote on television was The Letterman Show.
No. The first thing I wrote in television was a revival of Laugh-In'. They were bringing Laugh-In' back. So it was really weird. I went right out of art school into this revival of Laugh-In', which I got by submitting material. I moved to L.A. by myself with a car full of crap, like people do, on a weird dare that, well, actually, it came out of having taught art at USC. I started auditing classes at USC in other departments, and I started taking all kinds of filmmaking classes because I could. They were free.
Mm-hmm.
And then I sort of knew I could write because my mother kind of forced it on me. My mother was kind of a thwarted writer. Mm-hmm. Used to take my papers when I would write them in school and put editing marks all over them, like new paragraph and that sort of thing.
But what did your parents do that they didn't want you to be a showbiz floozy?
They were narcissistic and controlling.
That was their jobs.
Yeah. Yeah. One was that was their stage name, narcissistic and controlling.
Was it Rowan and Martin's new Laugh-In, or did you have a
different? Rowan and Martin were gone, but George Slaughter was still there. I'm the same original head writer, and they were still trying to repackage Socket Toomey jokes, but it was the wrong time. It was the 80s already, uh-huh. and which to people listening on your audience probably sounds like the 20s.
Yeah, exactly,
to me.
Sure.
But at that time, it was enough. I guess the original original Laugh-In was in the 60s.
Yeah, late
60s. So it was 20 years later, and there was no more Socket Toomey, just as there is none now. Perhaps it's coming back. Who knows?
Maybe Socket Toomey is the next new thing. Well, I think there's going to be a big resurgence of Tiny Tim very soon.
Yeah, well, Tiny Tim, was he on Laugh-In?
Yeah. He one of the first tapes of Tiny Tim is him doing Tiptoe Through the Tulips on Laugh-In in front of the I think it's a giant picture of Tiny Tim with the flowers around it. And then Dick Martin is in the shot with him just mugging.
Yeah.
You know,
oh, that mugging was the greatest.
Rolling his
it?
Eyes. And when he does the trill, you know, he acts as though there's a fly. Kind of goes to swat it. It's that kind of thing. But, I mean, Laugh-In had Nixon on and everything.
Yeah, that original Laugh-In did. I never found it funny. Did you?
I think
did you ever
that,
see it?
I did see it, and I saw it when I was a kid, and I was just so excited about the fact that people would show up who were rock icons. I was excited about like Tiny Tim and that kind of stuff. I did not think it was funny, but I thought it was really cool. You know, that whole look of it and stuff. But they try to do the joke wall, and you were.
I've always been in. Yeah, they did the joke. They did everything the same, and they had an all new cast with the only person who went on to have an actual career being Robin Williams.
He was on it, really?
Yes.
And they didn't have Rowan and Martin though, right?
It was no Rowan and Martin. No general team like that. It was just a group. Uh-huh. And the day they had a ton of writers. There was about 15 of us, and I was hired by accident. They tried to hire two women and then like 13 guys. And when I came in, my interview was, "Hey, come in here and take a look at Meryl Marco." They thought I would be a guy.
Oh, I see.
So by accident, they hired three women.
And do you remember any of the jokes you wrote for Laugh-In?
I sort of do remember some of the jokes. Something about some kind of a... You know, here's the thing. I didn't really match what they were going for because Saturday Night Live had just started. And I kind of came up on Saturday Night Live not laughing. So Laugh-In didn't strike me as funny. So they had us all sitting in little cubicles writing jokes, and then we would submit them at the end of the day in a giant file, and they'd number them, and they'd give us a Xerox back, and your joke would come back, and it would say number 450, number 7,210, number 62,750.
They would rank every joke? Or
they
just
were
the
filing
number
them, and then finally
in.
The script came in, and nobody's jokes were in it. It was all written by the head writer and the guy who was the producer, because we were all writing the wrong kind of joke.
Explain the numbering system. What was the numbering system?
I don't know. You know, I guess they were just counting them. I don't really know. I'm not sure what the numbering system was, now that you mention it, but I have a file of those number jokes at my house.
You have them? You have the
jokes, and I remember writing. We were all writing the wrong kind of joke, because that kind of joke they were looking for was a sort of a Socket Toomey joke. And then they had an all-new cast. They said, this is going to be the new Goldie Hawn, and this is going to be the new whoever the other...
Artie Johnson.
Artie Johnson.
Henry Gibson.
They had a
See,
different
I know,
one.
I know my Laugh-In.
Yeah.
Wasn't like Pigmy Markham on, too? Didn't he like do
He was.
Stuff?
Here Comes the Judge.
Yeah,
the Judge
was on. You bet
we
your
didn't
sweet
have one
Bippy
of those.
It was.
What's that?
You bet your sweet Bippy it was.
And they tried to do Bippy and Socket Toomey and
They
all
did.
That?
They did all that same kind of thing, and it just didn't match.
Did it ever go on the air?
It was on the air. A few of them were on the air. Like, I think they did six and maybe four of them aired.
And was Robin funny?
Robin just did his own thing.
Oh,
they just let him be the fire hose that he is. You know, uh-huh. He just came on and just said things. And
then right from Laugh-In to Letterman? Or were there
no, then
there?
That's right from Laugh-In to I met Letterman, and we were I met him at the Comedy Store. I started doing stand-up because I was so puzzled by what they were finding funny on Laugh-In that I just thought, I need a barometer. I need to see whether anything I think is funny is funny. So I started doing stand-up, and I met Letterman at the Comedy Store.
And when's the last time you did stand-up?
A couple months ago.
Oh, really? You still do it pretty often?
Intermittently, not too often. No, not. I kind of save it for benefits and when people invite me.
Mm-hmm.
I sort of did that alternative comedy scene where you don't have to have a laid out act. You just kind of goof around
and tell stories
kind of
stuff.
Yeah.
And kind of out.
Yeah.
And then it went from meeting Letterman to doing the. You did the afternoon show, right?
Well, yeah. That's what happened. Is that I met him, and then we started. He got a morning show.
Mm-hmm.
That was. It wasn't actually even an afternoon show. It was a live 90-minute a day on the air morning show, live.
What were they thinking?
They didn't know who he was. He, at the time, NBC It was NBC, and it was this guy named Fred Silverman. Do you remember him?
Yep.
He was considered the big programming genius, and he saw Dave, I remember this really specifically, he saw Dave as being a young Arthur Godfrey. So what he wanted was...
Was Dave happy being the young Arthur Godfrey?
Dave was just going to be Dave. He has no other way to be.
Uh-huh.
So he was going to be Dave, whether you call him the young Arthur Godfrey or you call him the old Johnny Carson. You're just like... He's going to be Dave, and he had me as his head writer, and I didn't know from the young or the old Arthur Godfrey, so I was just going to contribute what I could, and that was, it was all a mismatch. But this guy, Fred Silverman, intended for the show to be kind of the Arthur Godfrey show, which was apparently had a singer that came on every day and told stories, and women segments, and kind of cooking segments, and I remember they thought there would be makeover segments, and there might be an astrologer, and there was not going to be any of that on this show.
Those shows still exist?
You know, they did exist at my very house in my closet for until last year when I finally just shipped them to Dave. I mean, he wasn't coming for them, and I finally said, don't you want these? They were taking up an entire closet at my house, so they're around 3/4-inch tape.
Did you ever watch them after the time?
I couldn't watch them anymore because my 3/4-inch tape player broke,
sure.
And I'd have to get them all digitized.
Yeah.
So
were they good? Because I remember Jim Turner, who I consider to be one of the funniest people. He used to be with Duck's Breath Mystery Theater. He also did Arliss, and he was Randy the Redwoods on MTV.
Right.
I remember when that show first hit in the morning, Jim Turner came to me as though he was a Jehovah's Witness knocking on doors and saying there's a 90-minute show.
It was very wacky.
And he just said, it is the greatest thing that's ever been done on TV.
It was really out of place in time. It went on to become very similarly what the way the show started when it finally became the show that's on now, the earlier version of that. I mean, it was the same essential show. We were just going out on the street and doing weird things, and we had, you know, stupid pet tricks. We had all the sort of the same stuff, but it looked really wrong in the morning.
Yeah.
And I remember being at meetings where I would be the show representative arguing the case for the show with network people, and they would be going, women don't want this kind of show. And I would be the only woman in the room, and I'd be going, how can you tell me what women want? I'm the only woman here. Of course, I don't know what women want, and I was wrong. They didn't want that. So I was making a felonious argument. Also, I remember them really specifically saying to me when that show got canceled, because we had stupid pet tricks on it, when the show came back at night, I resumed again as head writer in order to just make some continuity there, and they said to me, well, we did a survey on the morning show, and people felt that they didn't want to see stupid pet tricks. They want trained animals. They didn't like just random weird behavior, so they'd like to see, I said, you mean like a horse that can count? And they said, yes.
So they wanted clever Hans.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to show off that I knew the name of the horse that could count and the animal.
I didn't know.
See, I just wanted to show that off, that I knew,
I'm
that I knew clever Hans.
Well, if you didn't know that name, who would know it?
Who would know that? That's, you know, when someone dies, you lose a library. When I die, no one will know who clever Hans was. But it was actually it was a very big deal. When was that, Godot? Do you know?
1800s, late 1800s.
Yeah.
Who said that when someone dies, you lose a library?
I just did.
But have you ever read that somewhere before?
Yes, I think it's a famous...
Because you know what? Here's what's really weird is I read... You know, do you ever Google yourself?
I don't, because it makes me crazy.
It would make you crazy. But I did one occasion, and I was quoted as being the person who said that. And
really?
I read that and said... I don't remember ever saying that, and I don't think I ever, I'm pretty sure that isn't me.
I think it's like Plato.
I think it must be somebody else, because it didn't seem familiar to me at all.
Maybe you're the first to say it in English.
I got credit for it somewhere online.
That is fabulous.
I was really blown away by it. I thought, I'm smarter than I thought.
Yeah,
wow.
I guess so. Well, I'm going to perpetuate that. I think it's a good idea. We got Meryl Marco, who's so much more than one of the aristocrats, and we'll be back after this on the Big Pat Gillette Show on Free FM. This is Penn Jillette on the big free FM, PennRadio@gmail.com, PennRadio.com, with Michael Godot, as always, sitting across from me. And
as
we have Meryl Marco, who's we're going to talk about, say the name of your book like every so often. So we
Walking in Circles with... walking in circles before lying down.
Okay,
so it's like an animal does before he lies down, you know.
I get it. I get it. Yeah. Even though I'm not fond of dogs, I know some of their behaviors.
I couldn't be fonder of them.
I know.
I'm fond of them every minute of the day. They just make me laugh. I get so much pleasure out of them.
I know. So many people do. So many people do. I just don't get the whole pets thing.
They're completely hilarious.
I guess so. What bothers me is not the pet itself. I don't mind watching animals, like watching a squirrel, and especially throwing something at a squirrel. It's my favorite entertainment. You know, if I can throw like a lighter at a squirrel and like hit him in the tail, nothing makes me happier. It's everything I love. It's, you know, it's the hand-eye coordination of the juggling. It's wildlife, and there's some cruelty. So it's everything. But the
and
idea,
why the lighter?
Because that's just the one I remember having a real solid hit.
Because you don't smoke.
I don't smoke, but I've sometimes sat at a table outdoors. Robbie Libin, who works in our crew, used to smoke like 5 packs a day. So I remember once picking up his lighter and just chucking it at a squirrel and getting a hit, and I was just so happy. And for those listening, I didn't hurt the squirrel. You know, I mean, you could throw a lighter at me.
You actually helped the squirrel, because the squirrel now knows when he sees anyone with a lighter and just get away.
It's better. They get further away from secondhand smoke.
Right.
And secondhand smoke.
For
squirrels
for
was a big problem.
Yeah,
you were head writer on the David Letterman show, which is
on the morning show and then on the night show for a while, until the relationship made me sort of start backing down in the way that nobody ever would, who had any sense in terms of career aggression.
Mm-hmm.
Because of personal interaction.
Yeah.
So that was...
So you made a personal decision that had some effect in your career.
Yeah.
But what I want to ask was, I have been around head writers. And really, when you're talking about, you know, fake macho, you know, I mean, real macho is you have to actually be shooting at someone or actually putting your life in jeopardy. But for fake macho, that Saturday Night Live thing and the Letterman when we were on.
Who are you thinking of?
I don't know, but it just seems like the writers
Faye?
Thing.
You're not thinking of Tina Fey, are
no,
you?
No. I'm not talking about that at all. But when we were on, when Saturday Night Live was considered at its worst, you know, and
which version of that was that?
When Lauren first came back.
Oh, you no, know? The worst was Gene Demania, and that was not.
Okay, we weren't that. We weren't that time. But the writers' rooms were this really like. Competitive and, you know, all the stuff. It has to be, I guess, to make a show. And there weren't at that time many women head writers.
You know, that was why I essentially got out of that and started working more as an individual unit, is that at some point that became very unsatisfying to me, too much collaboration. But to begin with, when I was ruling the roost, I mean, I was calling the shots, so I wasn't having any problem with competition. Anything I wanted was fine,
but
as long as I could get it by Dave.
How many writers did you have?
We started out, we had about 8, but I think they went far from that. I think they're up to about, like, 30 now. When you hear those lists read at the Emmys, they're endless.
Yeah, and did they all turned in a ton of jokes, and you just went through and picked them up?
No, I used to have, the group that I work with are mostly working on The Simpsons anymore. You know, uh-huh. They were a great group, and I'm still friends with a bunch of them. And let's see, how did we do it? No, we actually... It was not so formal. By the time I left there, it was kind of a lot of guys writing millions of things for top 10 lists. And at that point, I just thought, I'm done. I got to go do something else.
But you did more of the ideas for the departments and so on?
We were doing a lot more weird ideas when that show started than I think he's doing now. Although I have to say, I haven't seen the show in a while, so I'm not sure. But the things we were doing when the show started involved a lot of rehearsal and so forth, and that got grating to him, and who can blame him?
Yeah,
I mean, going down to a rehearsal all the time, rehearsing and rehearsing. And then I was doing a lot of the shooting stuff out on the street, and then I was doing all sorts of stuff. You know, I did a lot of, I was doing anything I wanted, basically.
Mm-hmm.
But the guys I was working with were fantastic, so there was... I hired them because I admired them, knowing that the things they were going to give me were going to be pretty good. And
well, you guys did stuff like rotating the whole picture for a whole show?
Yeah.
Is that when you were there?
Yeah,
was that after you?
Yeah. That, a particular favorite. You know who the idea I'm about to speak of came from? This guy named Randy Cohen, who's now the ethicist for the New York Times Magazine. I don't know if you know that he is inventor of Monkey Cam.
Really?
Yeah.
Really? Well, we know on this show we love monkeys. We do love monkeys. He's the inventor of Monkey Cam?
Yeah. I started with dog. I was doing these things called films by my dog Bob, and I was pretending that the dog had a cam on it. And then after that, we
pretending.
Well, I really actually, we didn't actually strap a camera to a dog. What we had in those days, back in the 80s, mini cams were kind of big compared to now when they really are teensy. But they weren't all that big then, but they were probably the size of a laptop. Mm-hmm. So they had a handle on them, and so you could just pretend they were the body of a dog, and you could just put them on the ground, and it would be as though a camera was strapped to a dog. Whereas now, you could get such a small camera, you could really strap it to a dog. So that was what we were doing.
You just add to that, for all I care.
For all I care.
You get a camera strapped to a dog.
For all I care.
And so you were doing that, and that was the first time that I know, even after Jim Turner had been raving about the earlier show, I first noticed it when you rotated the camera for the whole show and did mirror images and stuff, because I just really thought that this is thinking a different way about it.
Well, I remember the show that the one that I think of in that vein was that Randy came up with was that we voiced it over, like dubbed it,
yes,
but with different voices.
Yes.
So it was the identical. Somebody transcribed all the us and everything.
And then you looped it.
Looped it with other people.
Oh.
I thought that was really smart because it just disoriented you in a way that made you see everything completely different.
Now, was it a show that had been... I saw the dubbed one.
Yeah, that's what we aired, the dubbed one.
But there was not an original show.
There was an original show.
That never aired.
That never aired. We transcribed it, and then we had somebody come in and voice it.
Well, thank you. This has all made it worthwhile. I saw that show, and I said, I wonder if this show aired with the real voices before, because if it didn't, that's even cooler.
Yeah.
So it was even cooler.
Yeah.
They just looped it all in and dubbed it in.
Yeah.
Man, that was cool
but
stuff.
That's what we used to do, is parse it and figure it out, and I tried to figure out how you could mutate all the different elements and rearrange them and stuff, like have a different theme for a person each time somebody came on, or how could you isolate the different elements and just rearrange them, kind of.
So that was
a lot of fun to think of that stuff.
Yeah, it really is. And I can see why it ends up, you end up with those kinds of shows to want to have someone that you kind of understand on your TV every night. And I can understand why those shows end up regression to the mean, and his show ends up much more like Johnny Carson than it was when it first started.
Right. Well, you know what? He always wanted to be Johnny Carson, so he kind of got where he meant to. That was always his goal.
So
I never liked Johnny Carson.
So you, like many girlfriends, made him crazy. In your case, though, it was a good thing.
Well, yeah, I guess there was that. I mean, there was a moment there after his morning show where he was yelling at me and going, if it wasn't for you, we wouldn't have gotten canceled, because I was instigating a lot of weird things, because I never liked the Carson show.
Mm-hmm.
Carson always looked like a guy who didn't like women to me. Whereas Carson looked to all the guys I know like your favorite uncle and the guy that you wanted to be.
Mm-hmm.
The only women that were ever on the Carson show were June Wayne, was that her name? Or Carol Wayne, that's
Boy, there's a lot of hard quizzes. You got to get Clever Hands, Artie Johnson, and Carol Wayne. Yeah. Come on, keep them coming. I'm doing okay.
You're doing great.
Yeah.
Well, the smart women on the Carson show were always a really dumb woman who could goof around and had a good giggle.
Yeah.
Like the brain trust of the Carson show, I think, was Terry Garr, who is bright, but, plays dumb pretty well.
Don't mention Terry Garr.
Oh.
She's... Godot put a mouse trap off on her tongue.
What?
When she was sick. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh,
She came to do our show in City Spectacular, and she was a good sport. She'd do anything. And she was already having a lot of physical problems. And Godot had written a bit where she was going to pull her tongue out and set a mouse trap off on it in a gag about Teller. And he was demonstrating how close her tongue should get to it and holding the mouse trap. And he set
Is that true?
A mouse trap off on Terry
and
Garr's.
Hurt her?
Yeah.
Oh,
her.
My
it
God.
It was bad. We both cried a lot. And,
oh, my God. That's I don't
she,
even want to
I know.
Hear oh, my
I,
God.
That's what I said. Don't. It's ugly.
Oh, my God.
Still brings tears to my eyes.
Oh.
Terry Garr hates me. Can you imagine being the person Terry Garr hates? I love Terry Garr.
Yeah.
She hates me.
Yeah. I mean, I can't imagine if you mentioned to her Penn and Teller's Vegas show.
I'm not going
to. I'm sure she would just say they put a mouse trap off of my tongue. And
she hit me.
Well, that just proves that some of this stuff does go wrong. I mean, did you on occasion actually run over, tell her?
Yeah. Well, you know, we really pride ourselves. You know, it's awful that we pride, you know, because some people who do the kind of stuff we do really do get hurt and pride themselves at that. You know?
Oh, really?
You know, David Blaine and Chris Angel really do stuff that injures. And I always brag, you know, that no one's ever been hurt seriously. What I really mean is that me and Teller have never been hurt seriously. We did set a mousetrap off. And I know that if you set it to Terry Garr, and this is what makes me crazy, this is why I hate you, and someday I'll get back at you, is you know that if you talk to Terry Garr, she would say, Penn and Teller, set a mousetrap off of my tongue. It was just like the most horrible thing you can imagine.
You could change all that if you start giving him billing on your site.
Exactly. That's the way to solve it. With mousetrap programming, Michael Goodell.
Become a little more famous, and you've got your problem solved.
You also had Janine Garofalo shoot somebody, right?
Yeah, I did.
Well, she shot a lot of people.
Yeah.
So that was not such a big deal.
She shot one of the guys from Will and Grace, I think it was.
Yeah, she shot a guy from Will and Grace.
Who hasn't wanted to do that?
He had a blank pistol. And he told her, you know, before he told her keep it a good distance from him, she thought it wasn't.
Shot him in the face.
Pulled the trigger and shot him in the face. So that was the big thing on Sin City.
We'd taken the wadding out, so it didn't have wadding, but it still had like a little bit of sand.
Yeah.
She shot sand into his eyes with a pistol.
Oh, my God.
So that's what we've done.
So this is a good time for me to mention the name of my book, is Walking in Circles Before Lying Down. Oh, buy it, won't you?
And is it out?
It's out everywhere. I didn't even publish it myself. It's Random House. How do you like that?
Random House?
How do the books do? People like them, right?
Oh, some of them are, It's My Effing Birthday is the most beloved book since Tale of Two Cities.
Okay, good.
Those are the two... Oddly enough,
it works out like that. Well, first, I just got to get up to the list of Moby Dick and Atlas Shrugged.
The only climbing I have left to do.
And we're going
to
talk more about your book because we're not talking enough about that. Right after this, this is Penn Jillette and Michael Goodell set a mousetrap off on Terry Garr.
Shut up!
We'll be back on the Free FM. Here with Mike Goodell and Meryl Marco, and now I'm on. Right now, as we speak, I'm on Amazon.
Yeah.
Okay. So I type in, spell exactly what I type in.
My name?
Okay, yeah.
M-E-R-R-I-L-L?
M-E-R-R-I-L-L.
This is a very good plug.
Yeah.
M-A-R-K-O-E.
M-A-R-K-O-E. That's what I'm typing right now. And I'll give you guys time to catch up with me.
Okay.
You go to Amazon.com, M-E-R-R-I-L-L.
A theoretical audience is typing along?
Yeah.
Ah.
M-A-R-K-O-E, and then I'm going to hit go, and up pops, we'll see how quickly this is, Walking in Circles Before Lying Down, a novel by Meryl Marco, hardcover, buy new, and strangely enough, there's nothing under the used, because no one has ever sold this book. No one has ever sold this
book.
Came
out just like 2 weeks ago.
What Dogs Have Taught Me and Other Amazing Things I've Learned. So two dog themes.
Mm-hmm.
It's My Effing Birthday, a novel. And now, would you say effing when you're not on the radio? Or do you consider the title to be...
No, the title is the other way.
Okay.
If you write me a letter, I'll tell you what that word is that's been bleeped out.
Okay, good, thanks.
A lot of people don't know what that is.
Meryl Marco's Guide to Love.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
You know, I went to love seminars. When I wrote that thing, I went to like 25 or so love seminars around the city of Los Angeles to see what I could learn about love.
Are these just seminars for like lonely people to learn how to...
Are they
in relationships?
I guess they are for lonely people. Yeah, there are things like how to be attractive and how to be irresistible, actually, is what it was, how to be irresistible. And one was called How to Turn a Man into Putty. The joke immediately that came to my mind is it's really hard to remove putty. So I don't know if that's a good idea. But that one actually was one of the
items
where they gave out replicas.
Yeah. Really? And they taught you in the class?
Techniques.
Did you do well?
It's hard to say. There was no grading.
There was no grade?
No,
pass, fail?
You had to share those things with other people. And I just thought, well, this is something wrong with this. And other things.
Well, that's okay.
Yeah.
But I mean, if it was a car.
This is a very hard conversation to have on the radio.
Yeah, it is. Well, did you learn anything from those? Because, you know, we did a Bulls hit show on that, and And we had one of the seminars. It was just essentially a woman doing stand-up about relationships.
No, this was actually very informative. This woman had bothered to label and name. It's sort of the way they do when they're when a scientist is naming flowers. Mm-hmm. Now they name each thing something different. She had labeled and named. She'd parsed all things that can be done into a name of something and then mm-hmm. given it a technique. And
well, that's the first step.
Diagrams, and there was a notebook that came with it. It was very informative.
And have you
very peculiar.
Very peculiar, yeah. Well, Gina Fine in pornography always claimed to be the absolute best at that. And from all the evidence I have, seemed to be. How to Be Happy Like Me. Did you say you wrote three books? There's a million of them here.
Well, I wrote three novels.
Three novels, okay.
Right. I got backed into writing novels by accident. I thought I would just write commentary forever, but I'm suddenly writing novels.
And these are ranked by...
And I have something on Huffington Post, even as we speak right this very moment. I reviewed Kim Jong-il on cinema. You know he has books for sale on Amazon?
Does he really?
Yes, he does, and I bought them. I don't know how many he's selling. I'd have to look up his number.
And did you read them, too?
I did. I read them for purposes of knowing that I was going to write about them. So, I mean, that's the only way I could have gotten through them, because that is one guy working without an editor. I mean, he says something. He says something, and he says it again, and he says it again, and he says it again, and I can't even... If you want, during the next break, you can pull it up and you can read portions of it. But I couldn't rephrase it because there's no way to be that repetitive and strange. And he gives a lot of advice. It's pretty amusing.
On the Art of Cinema. Yeah, there it is.
And he's got one on opera.
Really?
He has some interesting ideas about how opera should be redone for the North Koreans.
Here you have the blog of Meryl Marco King... Oh, you have the opera one. Here's the opera one.
But if right now the cinema one is up on the I think it's on the front page.
Okay. Well, I'll go there. I'll go there right now. But I wanted to go through all of your books there. But I mean, do those things?
You know, what you want and what you do are two different things.
Okay. There are those love seminars. I'm really interested if people can help people on that.
I mean, when you went not
to,
really.
You went to all of them.
I would be very sad if I were really seeking anything besides amusing anecdotes from those seminars. Mm-hmm. And actually, you know what the saddest thing is? I saw somebody who works at my post office at one of them.
Oh, really?
A woman I've been looking at for years and worrying that I look like her. You know, if anybody like that, where you go, oh, no, I hope I don't look like that.
Well, you know, every big square-headed son of a bitch I look like, you know. Every single big fat guy with a ponytail comes up to me after the show and says, everybody says I look just like you.
Just what you want to hear.
And the answer is they do. You know, they really is. If you don't look... Like, if you're too big to look like someone famous, you look like me, you know? And I try to look and pick out the small differences, but if you're too old, you have a ponytail, you have glasses, you're fat, you're over 6'3", I don't think anyone would notice if you replaced me in the show. I really don't.
Have you ever tried it? It's sort of like Andy Kaufman was doing.
I know, exactly. I think you could put anybody in there. But I just didn't, you know.
That would be a great thing to try. You ought to try that one.
Just put another. Well, there are a couple of guys that do walk around L.A. One talked to Peter Falk for a long time. Peter Falk. I met the guy who created Columbo and was with him, whose name I've just blanked on. Oh, I did have Clever Hans right here. Bill Link. William Link, who created Columbo. And he came up to me at a magic convention. He's a magic buff. And he said, did you spend like 15 minutes talking to me and Peter Falk like about 2 weeks ago? And I said, no. He said, where were you 2 weeks ago? I said, I was right here in Vegas. He said, you weren't in L.A. at Spago's? I said, no. He said, I thought it was funny that you were standing in the line where all the fans are. But he said, you're wearing your suit. And I said, I don't wear a gray suit out in public. I'm wearing a T-shirt and jeans. He said, yeah. It's a guy in a gray suit, your size with a ponytail,
wow,
who yelled out to me, hey, Bill, I'm Penn. And then we had a chat with Peter Falk for a while. And I said, did he look anything like me? And I looked at Bill Link, and I realized that all he knew was, this is, you know, 6 foot six and 300 pounds coming at me. Must be Penn. Who else could it possibly
be? If I were your head writer, I would insist you do that show one time with him and get somebody who looks like Teller and just film the audience and see him.
How many people notice? Well, there are a couple of guys that do that because, you know, if you're going to be a celebrity impersonator, you have to look a little bit like somebody.
Yeah.
And if you look like nobody, you're stuck with me. So although there's no, you know, supply and demand breaks down here. The free market isn't working because nobody, there's no need whatsoever for a Penn impersonator, but there are people that look closer to me than
But nobody
else.
Talks like you, so that would be where it would get it to be amusing. You could probably get somebody who could do a reasonably good Teller for a while, although they wouldn't be miming correctly. But no, in addition to trying to negotiate the tricks, which would be impossible, nobody could do your rap. So that would be a very amusing kind of
thing. But they could
knock-off.
Go, rah, 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 rah. You know, like Stern used to be impersonation to me. I would go on show and go, rah, 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 rah. So
like he doesn't have a rap.
Well, you know, that's the whole thing. How to be hap, hap, happy like me? I'm still going to go through. The Day My Dogs Became Guys.
Yeah, that was my board of children's book.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
And, boy, there's a lot of different versions of the Psycho X game.
Yeah, there's some in other languages. And then there's a lot of versions of It's My Effing Birthday in other languages. I learned how to, I should know how to say that in a lot of languages now, except I've forgotten.
And you were on TV Nation?
I was. I did a couple of pieces after Your Own Heart. I went to a couple of prisons.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. I went to one prison where they were, they had the inmates selling tickets for vacations. They had them answering phones. It was before outsourcing.
Uh-huh.
It was in the 90s. I don't know when outsourcing started, but they used to outsource in prisons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They would do that, and you'd be calling up to have your catalog deals.
They had people call. People who were trying to book vacations were hitting people in prison who were taking their credit card numbers and so forth and booking their vacations for them. It was a very dubious kind of a honor.
Were there bad things about it, or was it just an okay thing that feels creepy?
I don't think that they could do anything with your credit card number if they're in a prison, but it felt wrong, you know, to be a guy who's in for murder and you're going, yeah, American Express, 422, seems wrong.
It seems to me just asking, well, what do you think, Tahiti or Bora Bora?
I couldn't leave, too. Yeah. That's the other thing. It was something very odd about it all. And then, of course, I learned, as perhaps you know, that everyone in prison didn't do anything.
Of course, absolutely.
Not a damn one of them.
Absolutely. And the funny thing is that everybody in prison is guilty of something.
Well,
you know, it's exactly the opposite. You know, it's just a really...
Well, there's the occasional person who didn't do anything, aren't there?
I think that if you know people who are defense attorneys and do that full-time, they will tell you about the one innocent person they had in their entire 40-year career.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so much rarer. But they often didn't do the... And what we have the court system for is not to protect the innocent, but to keep the police in line. You know, that's the way I believe. I believe let the guilty people go just to scare the government into not doing these things again. I mean, that's why the OJ outcome, I think, was good. Now we're going to be more careful next time we have a guy like this. I am on the Amazon page with Meryl Marco that I've typed in. MerrillMarkoe. And Walking in Circles Before Lying Down is her new novel. And she is a hero to me. My favorite person to write emails to. Whether you read the books or not, try to get her email address and write back and forth to her because you're the best correspondent.
Well, thank you. That's very nice of you to say.
And now, here comes the part where I say my name. This is Ben Gillette.